Okay, there's really too much to discuss in Bahar B'Chukosai, just in the sheni of these parshios. There's so much to say, and we have a limited amount of time today, so we'll just try to call your attention to some of the huge sugyas, really more in Parshas Bahar. Time permitting, we'll say a little bit about B'Chukosai also, but just what's in Parshas Bahar is a hugely impactful and hugely relevant. I think people don't always appreciate, if you were to talk about where much of our halachos of Dinei Mamonos come from, both Alpi Din and Alpi Hashkafa. So people probably first talk about Parshas Mishpatim. But the truth is, there are many other parshios that maybe impact that realm even more. Parshas Kedoshim certainly has a lot of impact. But really, if I were to pick the parsha that's most impactful in the themes of economics and business and the like, it's really Parshas Bahar, which has so much to say about economic realities. Of course, the mitzvahs of Shemitah, which are relevant and coming up, are in this week's parsha, which broadly goes to questions of economic systems, but also the specifics of finance and of commerce are really in this week's parsha, and some very important parts that are found in this aliyah. So we could talk about this aliyah for hours and hours, but we don't have hours and hours, so we can't go over. It's called Ribbis. It's also in this week's parsha. So we have to work within the limits that we have, but that's also one of the themes of this aliyah. So I'll just try to call your attention to some of what's happening here. So first, we'll be able to look at all the psukim inside, but first we'll start with the first pasuk of the second aliyah in Bahar. So v'chisim kuru mimkar la'amisacha, o kano miyad amisacha, al tonu isha sachiv. So there is so much just in this pasuk alone. The whole idea of kinyanim and how kinyanim work, and which kinyanim work when. So a lot of it can be traced to this section. And here we have the halacha of onah. So just to say a little bit about that in a very broad sense. So the prohibition of onah, the word means you should not afflict or oppress your friend. And here it is in the financial realm. So the prohibition of onas mamon, just translating the words, could mean lots and lots of things. But in the context that it is transmitted to us here, essentially what it refers to in English, probably the best translation is price fraud. That it is about taking advantage of the other person who you are dealing with and doing so in the context of price. So you could do that either by overcharging if you are the seller, or by underpaying. That if you know that an item is worth more than the seller thinks it is, and you pay too little, so that's also a violation of onah. And the Gemara suggests that really this is a type of theft, and it's not clear why it needs its own pasuk. And ultimately the conclusion the Gemara has is that because still, even if the price is wrong, but the purchaser is still agreeing to pay that price, knowing what it is, you're not secretly changing the number on his check. You're saying, okay, I'll sell it to you for $50, and he's agreeing to pay $50. He doesn't know that it's not really worth $50, so that's where the issue is. But it's still a more subtle demand on our integrity that you could say, listen, all right, it's his job to research it and to know what he's getting. So what's my problem if he's paying too much because he doesn't realize that the price is out of whack? So the fact that we do require such kind of disclosure and integrity is a high standard. And nonetheless, the Gemara suggests that there is essentially fraud otherwise, that it is a type of theft to take money under the pretense that an item is worth something when it really isn't worth that much, or vice versa, to be the one paying also. And we have a parallel concept here called mekachtos. Mekachtos is on the product side. So if I sell you an item where the price could have been correct, but the item is not up to snuff, the item is not what it's supposed to be, so then you have the right to give it back and to get a refund, and that's called mekartos. So here the issue is on the price side, that the item is what it is, but it's not worth what you're claiming it's worth. So if the issue is with the item itself, that would be a mekartos. If the issue is with the cost, that would be onah, and they're related concepts with slightly different halachos. So when it comes to mekartos, so it's reversible, and that's really based on a svara, that the assumption is the sale isn't a sale, that the person didn't think that he was buying this item, so therefore the sale should evaporate. Here we have a pasuk telling us what the story is, so it's interesting that it also shows you that it's not 100% intuitive, that you could have just said the same thing. Oh, well, I thought I was paying this much for something that was worth that much. I didn't realize it was worth less than that. So apparently that's not as obvious as mekartos. It's not as intuitive. And again, it reflects the fact that the Torah is demanding from us here a higher level of integrity, a higher level of honesty, while still rooting it in that. And that's really what we're talking about. We're talking about a prohibition of deception. And it's not the same thing as price gouging. That price gouging, in a sense, is really the opposite. It sounds the same, but it's really the opposite. Price gouging is when somebody exploits a great need. If there is, let's say, a crisis or some kind of an emergency or some other reason why there is a run on a certain item, and people are forced to pay high prices because they need it, so that's a whole different issue. And that really comes from a different place. And here, this is talking about deception, that you are fooling somebody into thinking that it's worth this much when really it isn't. While in the case of price gouging, the person knows what's going on. It's really in some ways the opposite. He knows that he's paying more than he wants to, but he has to because of the extreme need in the situation. So they're opposites also in the sense that in the case of onah, you could be getting this item for less somewhere else, but you don't know that. While in the case of price gouging, you can't be getting it anywhere else, and that's why you're paying a lot. And it's also interesting that they're fundamentally different, that from a perspective of pure economics, it's not clear that price gouging should even be considered wrong, because the factors that dictate price in the economic system, primarily supply and demand. So if there is high demand and low supply, so prices are high. So it's not necessarily clear how to pin down the moral issue. And Richard Thaler, who won the Nobel Prize a few years ago for his work in behavioral economics, so he writes in his memoir that the whole idea of behavioral economics is bringing the psychological elements into the economic realm. And he discusses there how, strictly speaking, price gouging isn't so obviously an offense until you bring in the fact that people get upset with it, get upset about it, that they are being exploited that way. So on a level of Beis Din, on a level of Midrabanan, so we have different enactments that are there to address situations of price gouging. But here, onah is more about deception and about the idea that the price that's being charged, the purchaser, usually the purchaser, because the purchaser is the one who tends to know less, because the seller, it's probably his business. So if you had to guess who's more likely to know more, it's probably going to be the seller who's taking advantage of the purchaser. But it could be the other way around, and it's explicit from the pasuk that you could have the issue in either direction. But it's based on this lack of knowledge. Now, it's interesting also that some point out that the language of kisim karu mimkar, it sounds redundant, that if you should sell some merchandise, why do you have to have that double language that you're selling merchandise? Merchandise is stuff that you sell. So some explain that there is a din in the Gemara that, let's say, if I want to buy something, it's not in the store. There's a guy who comes to paint my house, and I say, you have a great paintbrush there, you have a great truck that you use to drive around, I want to buy the truck from you. So he's going to say, but I don't want to sell you my truck. I use the truck to make a living. I don't want to sell you my paintbrushes. Those are not things that are part of my offerings. I don't sell the paintbrush. I come and do the job. So you say, yeah, but I really want to buy them, and they look tremendous. So he's going to have to be convinced to sell it, because he's not going to want to sell that what he uses for his daily living, and it's not something that he intended to put on the market. So in order to convince him to put it on the market, you're going to have to offer a lot. So then that's not a problem. Yeah, he has the right to say, listen, I'm not looking to sell this, and if you want me to sell it, then you have to really win me over with a big offer. That wouldn't be onah. So in some svarim, they say that's what the Torah is getting at there. It's a simkeru mimkar, that if it's merchandise, so then you have to be consistent with the market. You have to be in sync with what the price is. But if somebody is making a personal arrangement, trying to convince you to sell something that's not merchandise, that's not put up for sale, so then you can't expect that it's going to be parallel to any kind of going rate. But when it is merchandise, so then you have to be on track with what the rate is. And the din is that if it's more than a sixth, so then it's reversible. And here's where you have some things also different than mekartos. Mekartos, you don't have these kind of measurements. But when it comes to onah, that if it's going to be more than a sixth out of whack, so then the sale is reversible. And if it's exactly a sixth, so then you give back the difference and the sale is not reversed. And if it's less than a sixth, then there's no consequence. The sale doesn't get reversed and the differential does not get returned. So exactly a sixth, very hard to ever see that situation, because you have to know exactly what the value of an item is, exactly what the market price, and then figure out that the overage is exactly there. So that's not such a common scenario. But the other two, so if it's more than a sixth, the sale is reversed. And if it's less than a sixth, then it's not reversed. But many of the Rishonim hold, there's a discussion about this in the Rush and elsewhere, that that doesn't mean that it's permissible to overcharge by less than a sixth. It's still an Avera. It's just that the consequence of the sale being reversed is only triggered once you're that far out of whack. Once it's more than a sixth differential, so then that reverses the sale. But less than that, it's not reversed, but not because it's mutter, to knowingly overcharge. So that's something that is still prohibited. It's only that if the overcharging is less than a sixth, so then we assume mechila. Now it's interesting here also, because to assume mechila, so we have that concept, for example, if somebody were to steal less than a shava pruta, so you don't have to return less than a shava pruta, but it's still an avera. You're not allowed to steal any amount. But if it's less than a shava pruta, you don't have to return it, because we assume that the victim is mochel. That's not enough for him to care about. But there, you know, it's a very small amount. It's less shava pruta. Here, if you're off by, let's say, you're off by 10%, so it's not a sixth, but that could be a lot of money. And so if you're buying an expensive item, so it could be hundreds or thousands of dollars that you're off by. So why should we assume that the person is mochel on that? So that seems to convey also that the isser here is not about the money, the isser is about the deception. So we do understand that there's a certain amount of fudge factor, there's a certain percentage where it's hard to really tell whether you're being honest or not, because the subjective factor may play a role. So when it's more than a six, people are like makbid on that, then they don't want to put up with that, they're not going to accept such a deception. But if it's less than a six, so then they can tolerate, okay, that that is within the gray area where there is some subjective difference. But still, for a person to knowingly charge more, so, and knowing that he's taking advantage of trying to push what he can, because there'll be that subjectivity, so many Rishonim understand that that's still wrong. But it's not necessarily actionable. So in the Shulchan Aruch, they bring both dais, and they say that it depends, like we've sometimes discussed in other contexts, should have a double standard, that for yourself it should be more machmir, and don't overcharge at all. Somebody else does it to you, so you should be mochel and assume that it's within the range of what's reasonable. And we find, hi, Ari, yeah?
Yeah, so if
the
price is more than one-sixth,
do
you still inform the buyer is that problematic?
So if they're being open about it, so then, and they know what's going on, he informed him before he before he pays for it. So then, you know, it's not a deception. The real yisod of this avera is the deceptiveness. So, and even passive deceptiveness. It doesn't mean that you necessarily scheme to do this, but that you allow deception to happen, even if you don't know. But that it happens under mistaken pretenses. So that's the issue. But if you tell the purchaser, listen, you could get this for much less, but this is the deal. You come in here and you're paying this much. Maybe I've got maybe it's legitimate. Maybe I have an expensive store that I have a lot of upkeep, and you buy this online, it'll be cheaper, but you're going to buy it in the store where we've got a showroom and we have salespeople we have to pay for, and we have electricity bills, so the price is higher. And everyone understands that, so then it's not deceptive. But so if that's spelled out, so then that's not the issue. But if a person feels he was exploited, so and it's more than a sixth, so then he could ask for this refund. And it's an interesting question whether it's davka the zchus of the victim or if either side could. Maybe even the perpetrator could reverse it. Yes, that's the discussion. But we see that this consequence of a reversal isn't completely parallel to the avera. You could have one without the other. So there probably are a couple of examples. So first of all, charging less than a sixth, overcharging by less than a sixth, according to many Rishonim, would still be the avera of onah, but wouldn't trigger this consequence of a sixth. And we also find that, and that seems to really prove the point, because we find it by real estate. Because regarding real estate, so that we say ein onah lekarkos, that we don't have this application of onah in the context of real estate. But there, as the Ramban points out, it sounds like we have to be talking about the consequence and not about the avera, because how do you know that the avera applies to real estate? So you know that from this week's parsha, because that's the context. We're not going to have time to go into all the details here, but if you keep reading the psukim, that's what we're talking about, that we're talking specifically about selling real estate and about taking advantage of price differences in either direction. So clearly there is an isser that should apply in that context. It just means that you don't have the same 1/6 standard. So why should that be? So as I'm explaining, because you know, when it comes to real estate, we know the three most important factors in real estate, right? Location, location, and location. So what that means is that it's not like other things where you could say to somebody, oh, I didn't want to buy it from you. I could have bought it from the guy across the street for less. But here, no two houses are exactly the same, even if they are very, very, very similar. But if they're a block away, I could say, I want the house Hidavka here, and there's no other house in the world that is this exact house. So it's harder to pin down that there's an actual actionable overage there. Even so, some of the Rishonim say that there still is a point where it does become too extreme. So maybe it's not a six, but maybe it's by, if it's twice the value, so then maybe it does trigger such a reaction. And we also have this as far as an Akum is concerned. So we have a notion that there's no Onoah by an Akum, but as the Mishnas Yaakov emphasizes, doesn't mean that you're allowed to overcharge. It means that the consequence is different because you have a different set of understandings and you have a different system that's going to be operating between the two people. But knowingly overcharge is certainly prohibited across the board. So in those three cases, you have the avera, but without this consequence of necessarily triggering a reversal at a certain point. So this issue of onah is really a fascinating topic. There's really a lot to explore about its implications across the board. It also has major implications way outside our scope for now, but in the area of shiduchim also. So both in terms of the disclosure that is necessary before marriage, and also the consequences and implications of not fully disclosing whatever might be relevant to agreeing to enter into such a commitment. So the halachos of onah and mekachtos, both in terms of an aver l'chanchila and in terms of whatever implications it may have, is a very extensive discussion, obviously with huge, huge consequences, dvarim ha'omdim b'rum shalolam. But so this topic of onah, really, we could speak about all year. It's a topic which has tremendous, and there are many, I'm looking at my shelf here, a tremendous, huge svarim on the topic of onah. because it really goes to the whole essence of the economy and how transactions are conducted, and what there is to say about it. There really is quite a bit, and then carrying it over into the area of marriage. So that opens up a whole other realm to talk about, and there's much to say. So speaking about opening up in the context of marriage and what to talk about, so it's also important to emphasize that so much in this Aliyah, but towards the end of the Aliyah, so it comes up again, so here it's a segue for marriage, because the Gemara says that in the context of the relationship between a man and his wife, the prohibition of onah takes on extra significance here, onah's dvarim. So this second reference to onah, as Rashi tells us, is the prohibition of onas devarim, which we normally translate as inflicting emotional pain. And here the relationship to the overall idea of onah is interesting. Some understand onas devarim to also be the source for the prohibition of Gnevas Das, that we know that we have a prohibition to deceive people, even if it's not going to have a monetary consequence, but it's going to have a more subtle, intangible consequence. So that's a violation called Gnevas Das, and it's the discussion what the source of Gnevas Das is. But the minority opinion, the Rav is the opinion that it's from this pasuk, that it's a type of onah also, that just like when you deceive somebody about the monetary value and you take value from them in the dollar sense under false pretenses, that's onas mamon. So onas devarim is when you take more intangible value from somebody under false pretenses. So that's the Gnevas Das. But we also have many other examples of what onas devarim applies to. And the Mishnah, in the end of the fourth parak of Bav Metzia, lists off a whole bunch of examples. That there, the fourth parak of Bav Metzia is really all about these psukim. It starts off talking about kinyanim and about currency, and then goes through all the halachas of onah, and then at the end of the parak, the Mishnah tells us that kishem shiyesh onah b'mamon kach yesh onah b'dvarim. And there's a lot written about trying to understand the significance of that kishem, about that equation of the two, but there's a prohibition in the monetary realm, and there's also this prohibition in the emotional realm of onah's dvarim. And the Gemara has a number of examples, which basically all seem to be along the lines of if you are inflicting some kind of emotional pain in the way you talk to somebody and the things that you bring up, in using certain kinds of language that are going to arouse hurt feelings, so then one's in violation of onas devarim. One of the more well-known examples, and one of the more mysterious examples, which also has a lot of practical relevance, and it goes back into the business world especially, is that the Mishnah says that you're not supposed to ask a merchant about the price of something when you have no intention to buy it. So why is that onas devarim? So that's an interesting question. There are at least three or four explanations in the Rishonim, maybe more. The most common explanation is the idea that you're inflicting emotional pain because the person is going to be disappointed. He thinks he's going to make a sale, and it turns out that he's not going to make a sale. There was never a chance of him making a sale. So he's going to get his hopes up, and then he's going to get disappointed. Rabbi Levine, Zichron Levracha, talks about this extensively in his books. He uses the term dashed expectations. That's that understanding. That a person has an expectation that's dashed. So that is one idea that's included there. Now, clearly, we can't say that you're not allowed to ever give anyone the hope of something that's going to turn out not to work out, because then you should never be able to ask about anything if you're not 100% sure you are going to buy it. You should never be able to go on a date if you're not 100% sure you're going to marry the person. So we understand that when it's necessary, it's part of the way the world has to work. You have to be able to have a conversation about a business deal. You have to be able to explore whether something could work or not. So that's necessary. So that's not a violation of onas devarim, but to inflict unnecessary disappointment and unnecessary emotional pain. So that's where you have this prohibition. Other interpretations about what the issue is about pricing something. So some understand that you're wasting the salesperson's time, that their time is set aside for business and you are using it for your own curiosity. So that's not fair. And it's comparable, as Rebecca Kamenetsky used to object, people would daven mincha, so they don't want to look like they're talking to themselves, so they would take a payphone, and they would pretend to be talking on the payphone, so they taking away business from the phone company that has the phone there in order to be used for business purposes, and you're going to appropriate it just to pretend like you're talking when you're davening. So I thought that was a problem. Luckily, nowadays, it's not relevant anymore, because not only does everyone have cell phones, but technology is so small that you would never look like you're talking to yourself. I've always assumed that there's some kind of a device somewhere. But in any event, so that's another understanding. Some also understand that it could also hurt the person's business, because you could cast aspersions on the item. Because if, let's say, somebody would overhear the conversation, and I would ask, how much does this cost? And then he gives me a price and I walk away. So a person who witnesses this is going to think, oh, it must be overpriced, because I asked and then I decided not to buy it after I heard the price. But the mice had never had a chance. There was no chance, no price was going to be right. So it's not fair. I could be hurting this person's business unfairly. Rabbi Bleich Shlita has an article about Anos Tavarim where he suggests that the common element of all the examples in the Mishnah, you can take a look there, all the examples is that you are treating the other person like they are inferior to you. So instead of there being an equal mutual benefit relationship, you're treating them like they're there for you. So, for example, when you go into a store, so you want to talk about the price, so the seller is interested in talking about the price because he may be able to get a deal here. He may be able to sell something. And the Maisa, you're just curious. You're not there with any benefit for him. So you're treating him like he's your personal information site. So that's not fair. It's basically a degradation of the person. So all these different interpretations of what the issue is with pricing the items, there's a lot of nafgaminas for the modern market, because there's all kinds of different assumptions, and you have the internet to scope out prices, and so the applications can be very complicated. Also, probably if you were to ask the average larger store, certainly, would they rather people come in and ask about things that they think they're not buying? They probably say, definitely, you know, and then they'll assume that you will come to buy. So you have to figure out exactly the application of these concepts. But the application is a further discussion, but this is a part of trying to understand exactly what the Mishnah is getting at. And there are a few examples that you find in the Rishonim that are not in the Mishnah, which is also interesting. So, for example, the Rambam talks about in one place about if you ask somebody, if you ask a rabbi questions that he's not holding in. So that's it's not the subject that they're talking about, so that's a nos dvarim, because you're going to embarrass him if he doesn't know the answer. So that's difficult, you would imagine, because certainly nowadays nobody holds back. You ask whatever's on your mind, and you don't assume that you're only allowed to ask whatever they're learning today. So how do you understand that? So I saw once in the Sefer V'Drashta V'Chakarta that he had an interesting interpretation. It's based on a Gemara in the beginning of Shabbos. You can take a look there. But without taking the time to go through the whole back and forth in the Gemara, but basically what he explains, and if you look there, and we're in the very beginning of Shabbos, it fits very well what's going on there, that some people, they ask a question, and it's a little bit of like an ambush, because, you know, you'll ask the rabbi, okay, is this mutter? And he'll say, yeah. And then he'll say, oh, it's funny, because the Taz says it's usser, so I'm surprised you think it's mutter. And, you know, then it's like an ambush. So the way to ask the question is to say, you know, I don't know if this is mutter or usser. I see the Taz says it's usser. What do you think? So then you're putting everything up front, and you don't have that ambush element. So that's what that Gemara sounds like, that there's a way to ask a question that's really going to set somebody up for an embarrassment unnecessarily. And that's what perhaps is included in an Anos Devarim. It's also interesting that Rashi in Chumash, right? So Rashi gives you an example of here where you talk Rashi here in our parsha, and so Rashi says, "Kan hisher al Anos Devarim shel yaknis chavero." Right? You shouldn't hurt somebody's feelings. V'lo yasianu eitza she'enu hagenis lo, and you shouldn't give him bad advice. Lefi darko v'hanasa shel hayotzit. That you shouldn't give him bad advice. That's really for your own purposes. So some raise the question, which, you know, it's not the kind of question necessarily has to keep you up at night so much, but that isn't this already included in the prohibition we read a few weeks ago, prohibition with Ne'ivra L'Sitei Michshol. So there is an Isser to give somebody bad advice from that pasuk. So why do we need it from both psukim? So I'm not sure if the question has to be so problematic, because both Lifnei Iver and Anas Devarim are both broad Isurim that have a lot of examples, and in one example it may overlap between the two. But nonetheless, there could be Chilukim. So Rabbi Levine, for example, in one of his Svarim, so he discusses Chiluk between the two. He says that it depends. If you give somebody bad advice and they follow the bad advice and they suffer because they follow the bad advice, that's a violation of Lifnei Iver Lo Sitein Michshol. But let's say you give somebody bad advice and they don't follow it. Why do they not follow it? Because they caught on. They're smarter than you think they are. They caught on that it's bad advice, and they're now insulted by you. You insulted their intelligence. So that's Anas Devarim. That's what you suggest, that that's different examples. There's both an Anas Devarim version and a Lifnei Iver version of Anas Devarim. But there are a lot of other examples also, and it doesn't necessarily have to always involve actual words. The Sefer Yireiim understands that if you walk around with a nasty face, an upset look, so then that's also Anas Devarim. My father, Zichrono Livracha, used to like quoting Rabbi Shaul Salanter, said that a person could be upset about something, but their face is a Rishus HaRabim. Everyone sees their expression, and that's going to bring sad feelings to others, and that's something that you have to worry about. So recently, people walk around with masks on their face, so you don't have to necessarily worry about that specific detail as much if no one can see. But if you are conveying bad feelings to others through your expressions, so the Yireiim understood it's also a violation of Anas Devarim. There was also a discussion that, that we know, if you ever go to summer camps, they tell you there's a prohibition in the Torah of Gezel Shena, that if you're going to wake somebody up, you're going to talk late at night, you're going to wake people up when they're sleeping, it's a prohibition of Gezel Shena. So this is an interesting discussion. So where does that prohibition come from? There's a couple of possible candidates, but the Tshuvas Karen LeDavid in Simon Yud Ches, the Tshuvas Karen LeDavid writes that it's a prohibition of Anas Devarim, that to cause somebody discomfort and to cause somebody distress, you're going to wake them up, they're going to be upset. So that's also included in the prohibition of Anas Devarim. And we also know that, as the Gemara goes on to say over there in Bava Metzia, in the end of the fourth parak, so the whole sugi of Habanus Pnei Chaveiro Berabim is there, the idea that causing humiliation to somebody, so that's an extreme violation of Anas Devarim. So that's something that takes it to a whole other level, and there's all kinds of greater consequences for that. It's compared to Shvichus Damim, and extensive discussion in the Svarim as to how literal is that comparison. And the Gemara says also to call somebody by a demeaning nickname is also included in its own category of inflicting emotional pain, and also has very severe consequences to it. So that's all an outgrowth of this idea of Anas Devarim, something that we have to be very careful about. And as I mentioned before, in the context of marriage, the Gemara there says that Hizare Be'Anas Ishto, that somebody has to be very careful. The more the relationship is a sensitive one, and the more it's likely that a person is going to take it very intensely and is going to start crying, a person has to be even more careful about the situation of Ana. And the Torah repeatedly tells us in the context of a ger, where there is a more profound sense of separation sometimes, or alienation, so then the sensitivities are greater, and there has to be even greater care. And either in that case, there are additional prohibitions connected with inflicting any kind of Ana. So there's no question this is something we have to be very, very careful about. Now, nowadays, it's a whole question in terms of the culture as to how things are taken, and there's certain types of sensitivities which may sometimes come to seem extreme. So we have to figure out exactly how to relate to that, because it is true that the Mishnah is telling us that you have to be careful that an individual may have a personal sensitivity which is different from others, and therefore there is a concept of trigger words, there's a concept of language that will take on a double meaning and will end up causing suffering to someone, even though it doesn't necessarily have that meaning to anyone else. So the Mishnah says, if somebody had a relative who was hanged, so you say to him, could you hang this fish? They're going to hear the word hang, it's going to bring about emotional pain. So that's something that also is included in Anas Devarim. So there is certainly such a notion. But you have to figure out how much is that true when the speaker is not intending to to inflict that pain. Because you could certainly imagine somebody who's being very sneaky, and he's going to look like a tzaddik, and he'll say, okay, I'm just talking innocently. Oh, yeah, that's something that that person has a history with. Oh, who knew? I didn't realize. So here you see that Rashi tells us that the idea of Yireisa Melekecha is included in this pasuk, right? And we know that the phrase, when the Torah reminds us that God is watching, and that we should be reverent to that, we should be fearful of that. So very often it's because of Davar HaMasu L'Lev, it's something that one can claim innocence, and we don't know what they're really intending. So here that's what Rashi says, that V'yim Tomar Miyodeya Miskavanti L'Ro. So who knows if I really intended, I could say, I didn't mean anything bad, I'm just talking innocently. So it sounds like what we're saying is that the real issue here is that the person is trying to inflict emotional pain, and he could pretend to be innocent. It may also be in the context specifically of that example of bad advice, but it sounds like it's also broader, that the real issue here is that you're going to try to make people sad, and you'll do so behind the claim that you were just talking innocently. So that's where you really have the issue, and that's also how we should be judging people who say things that are hurtful. Understand that the real issue is that they shouldn't be trying to cause emotional pain and to attach a lot of blame to somebody who inadvertently uses language that's painful. It's not on the same level. Now, at the same time, we have to still work very hard to try not to cause anybody emotional pain, even inadvertently. So there's no question that this is something we discussed last week, right? We talked about last week about with a woman and that whole discussion about giving an aliyah to somebody who's in that category, or about how the shir should be conveyed. So l'chadchila, you want to be very careful not to cause anybody emotional pain, even when that's not your intent. But the question here is, again, in terms of the double standard, in terms of how do you judge somebody who does that. So the isser, in the formal sense, is very likely addressing somebody who's doing so intentionally, and perhaps also sneakily. Right, there's three levels. You could do so completely unintentionally, you can do so intentionally, and you can do so intentionally and sneakily. You can say things that are hurtful and hide them behind things that sound innocent. So that's for sure a violation of an ostevar. But ideally, we wouldn't want to cause emotional pain in any sense, certainly unnecessarily. So all of that is something that we are very careful about. But nonetheless, you know, we have to understand the different levels here and respond accordingly. And another way to cause emotional pain through speech is by keeping them too long. So we'll just speak for another few minutes just about Parsha B'chukosai, much, much shorter earlier. But here, this is before B'chukosai turns scary. It's talking about the good things and about if you will follow my Torah, im chukosai telechu, so it starts off good. So here, coming off of that theme, so the second aliyah, we'll just look for a second related to the first pasuk, says, v'nasati shalom bo'aretz, v'shchavte ve'machirid, v'shpati chayra min ha'aretz, v'cherev lo sabar ba'aretzachem. So it's going to be good for you, and you'll have shalom. So here it's interesting, Rashi says that before the end of the first aliyah, it just said you're going to have great blessings of food and sustenance. So Rashi here says, Shem etomru hori maichol v'hori mishta. So you have food, you have drink. It means shalom ein klum. So you might say that, okay, so then what good is it if I don't have shalom? Tamad lomar, acher kol zos v'sati shalom ba'aretz, mikar shalom shakol k'neged kol. So we see that shalom ultimately is the most important, that if you don't have that, then it doesn't matter. You can have all the greatest luxuries, you can have all the food and drink in the world, you can have everything. But if you don't have shalom, then it's not going to count for anything. It's like the Mishnah says that there's no kli machzik bracha like shalom, that brachos might be other things. But if you don't have the shalom, there's nothing to put it in. The kalim are going to collapse, and all the bracha is going to spill out. So if you want your bracha to be able to be used and be able to be sustained, then you need to have shalom, which also relates to this whole idea of avoiding onas devarim and avoiding things that are going to make people angry at each other. Very often, a lack of shalom comes from people talking in such a way that they antagonize each other, and then they're seething inside. And that's the connect also what we saw in the second aliyah of Kedoshim. A person gets very annoyed at the way someone's talking to him, and then eventually it overflows and it erupts. So here Moshe Feinstein says that to read this pasuk, we have to assume that we're talking about internal shalom. You'll have shalom with yourselves. Otherwise, the whole pasuk is not going to make sense. That's how the Ibn Ezra comments and how the Aruch Chaim comments. There won't be any pirud levavos. There won't be any internal separation by people. So it's also interesting, this idea of getting rid of the animals. So what exactly does that mean? So here, if you look at the Ramban quotes the Torah's Konim, and what this bracha means, that you're not going to have animals. So the Ramban quotes from the Medrash two different days. One is that the cities will be so filled with people, you're not going to have animals come in. You know, that's something that we see in nature, that the animals, the dangerous animals, will tend to occupy a space where people aren't there. And so there is a correlation between the two. And the other opinion is Rav Shimon, it'll be like Adam Harishon Kodem Achet, that even the animals that are there, they're not going to attack people. So this is an interesting idea of Bechlal, the Rambam in Hilchos Melachim, when he talks about the Messianic era. So the Rambam focuses on the idea that there isn't going to be any physical change in the world. What Chazal say is that Ein Bein Olam Hazeh Mosa Mashiach Chutz Mishibin Malchius, that there'll be peace in the world, but the Metzius of the world is going to be the same. The laws of physics aren't going to change. So based on that, he says the idea of the wolf and the lamb lying down together, so the Rambam says that's a mashal, because since the other parts of reality are not going to change, it's a way of talking. It's talking about human beings. It's saying that people who are at war with each other are going to be able to coexist. So the Ravid says against the Rambam over there, he says, how do you know it's a mashal? Look what's going on in this pasuk. Doesn't sound like it's impossible to say that there will be fundamental changes in nature. Like if we just said that the animals aren't going to attack, like it's going to be like the Marishon Kodem Achet, so then maybe it is conceivable that the wolf and the lamb is an actual literal statement of what's going to happen. So the Rabbah's response to the Rabbi says, this pasuk is also a mashal. Why can't they both be like that? So some suggest, and the same for all Moshe, and he quotes, others quote also from Rabbi Soloveitchik, that maybe it means that here it's in the context of Nevuas Moshe. Moshe is conveying the prophecy to the people, so that's got to be literal. That's not the context of for a mashal. But in other contexts, in Pesukim Menach, you can have prophecies that could potentially be more symbolic and more of a parable. But again, the Iker is Shalom, and our hope that we can bring about internal peace and that we can bring about lasting peace in the world, and they all go together. And a lot of it is how we treat each other. So the second Aliyah of Bahar very much connects to these themes, that if we treat people honestly in business, and not only without overt deception, but really with a very high standard of integrity, that it's not enough for us to say, okay, you agreed to pay this price, so that's it, but that we really work to make sure people know what they're getting and that they are fully on board. And again, if you were to explore the halachos and the concept of onah, you'd find some very fascinating things about just how much we are really looking to bring a very high standard of integrity and disclosure in transactions to people. So, and in the context of marriage also, the necessity to make sure that people are fully aware of what they're getting into and are entering into that relationship with a full understanding. And the concept of onos dvarim and how it impacts relationships overall, these types of verbal digs that have a accumulated impact. So at first may not seem like such a big deal. People talk like this in a consistent way. It really erodes relationships and has a tremendous impact, and it's something which we have to try to be very, very sensitive to, and not only the most blatant type of explicit onos dvarim, but to whatever extent we're able to fine-tune our sensitivities so that we don't bring about unnecessary offense, even inadvertently. So that does a tremendous amount for shalom, and this is a big part of this nevuah. In the second part of B'chuk Hosai, that if we are careful to keep all the fundamentals of the Torah in every sense of the word, we should be zoche that we'll have the mitzvah of shalom. We'll have the mitzias of shalom, which is the kli machzik bracha. And as we head towards the Kabbalah Satorah and the last stage of Sfiras Omer, where we focus on being nohi kovid zelazeh, so this emphasis on how we talk to each other, and the atmosphere that we create in relating to each other takes on added importance. So I will leave you with that bracha. We have a hiatus now for a few weeks before June, so I will wish you that you should have only elevated encounters with each other, and that our ability to internalize all of the sensitivity to contribute to the Metzias of Shalom should be maximized to the fullest intent. I wish you an uplifting Shavuos. It should be a Kabbalah Satorah in every sense of the word, and you should be able to bring together all of these things that we've tried to emphasize and work on. And I look very forward to seeing you when we reunite in June. So that should be a wonderful Shabbos, a wonderful Yontif, a wonderful few weeks, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.